Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I think I'm going to begin. It's just after five. And I'll show you a nice picture to look at. Correggio is a small town near Parma in northern Italy. It gave its name to Antonio Allegri, who was born there in 1489 and died in 1534. Nowadays, he's an incomparably less famous figure than Leonardo, Michelangelo, or Raphael, but was at least their equal in the estimation of the 17th and 18th centuries. My subject this afternoon, his dome fresco in Parma Cathedral, is one of the most explosively original and influential works of art of the 16th century. It went much further than any of its precursors in this department, but it did not come out of nowhere. As a rule in these lectures, time constraints mean I've reluctantly resisted the temptation to give any background to the works which are my subjects week by week, but today I am going to break that rule. The idea of opening up the heavens in illusionistic fashion in a fresco was not completely new. The first great, if more modest, breakthrough came with what you're seeing, the vault of Andrea Mantegna's so-called Camera degli Sposi in the Palazzo Ducale in Mantua, a room which was painted between 1465 and 1474. There is good evidence to support the idea that the teenage Correggio was a pupil of Mantegna's in the years before the latter's death in 1506, and soon thereafter he was certainly responsible for the frescoes in the cupola of Mantegna's funerary chapel in the Basilica of Sant'Andrea in Mantua, which you see. By the late 1510s, Correggio was in Parma, where he frescoed the vault of a room in the private apartments of the abbess of the Benedictine convent of San Paolo, with an irresistible and resolutely pagan fresco decoration. Incomparably more crucial for the Duomo, however, was his dome fresco in the Benedictine Abbey of San Giovanni Evangelista, which, together with a now in large part destroyed apse fresco and other decorations, dates from the first half of the 1520s. I cannot dwell on this project, but its importance as a precedent for the even more ambitious Duomo fresco is obvious, I think, if you see them together. Moreover, it does seem imperative at least to mention a very recently rediscovered autograph letter, which was hiding in St. Petersburg, sent by Correggio on the 20th of July 1519 to Girolamo da Monferrato, a major figure in the Benedictine order, its president in 1521, and abbot of San Giovanni Evangelista from 1522 to 24. In it, Correggio states that he has been in Parma for 8 days and that, for the fathers of San Giovanni, I have already agreed to do in the cupola of their church the ascension of our Lord with the 12 apostles, with other histories and friezes for the church. He adds that the whole project is likely to take around 4 years. On the 3rd of November 1522, Correggio signed a contract with the Fabbricieri, the lay factors of Parma Cathedral, in the presence of all the cathedral canons. In it, he agreed to paint the cupola, the vault leading to the high altar, the apse, and all visible parts of the walls leading to the apse. The entire surface area was calculated at 150 square pertiche, which is perches, a colossal expanse. Correggio was to receive the commensurately immense sum of 1,000 ducats. The figure of 1,200 is crossed out in the document, and 100 ducats for materials. He was to include whatever storie, histories, would be given to him, whether to the life or imitating bronze or marble, as appropriate, which seems to suggest that no details of the decorative scheme had yet been determined. Correggio further stipulated that he required a large room or closed chapel per farli disegni, to make the drawings. That must be to say the cartoons. It is frustrating that nothing more is said concerning the subject matter, which I will be exploring later on. However, an agreement drawn up on the 17th of May, 1547, between the authorities at the monastery of San Benedetto in Ferrara and an all but undocumented painter called Lodovico da Modena, gives an intriguing insight into what might have been required of Correggio. No such fresco exists in Ferrara, and it may indeed never have been executed. Lodovico is to paint the main cupola from the top to the bottom of the four peduzzi, which means corbels, of the crossing. The document then explains, and I quote, first that the said Messer Lodovico has to begin the said work at the beginning of next month, work on it continuously, and make all the figures with his own hand. The work has to be in the following manner, namely, at the summit of the said dome, the Ascension of our Lord with the apostles, all large figures in proportion to the height and size of the said dome, with the heavens and angels in clouds, so that it is pleasing to a man of judgment, and that the uppermost cornice, which will be the first one below the apostles, should include 8 well-painted fictive marble columns. Then, between the columns of the dome, where there are no windows, he is to paint 2 prophets on an appropriate scale, and where there are windows, 2 puttini holding festoons to either side of the windows, in accordance with the drawing given. The second cornice from the top is likewise to be of fictive marble, and there he is to paint a festoon or whatever seems fit to a good judge. Below the second cornice, he has to paint appropriately the 4 patriarchs. There then follow the financial arrangements, which, as was customary, involve payments in installments. All commentators have accepted that it was Correggio's work in San Giovanni Evangelista that had impressed the cathedral authorities. Indeed, at least in relation to enterprises of this enormity, the idea of such a commission tends not to exist in the abstract. On the contrary, it is inspired by the availability of an exceptional artist. What is more, it must have been the overall plan to cover San Giovanni with frescoes by a team of painters that encouraged the even more grandiose cathedral project, which similarly involved a vast program of other frescoes by a number of other artists. The grand design for the cathedral was arguably overambitious from the start and ran into countless practical difficulties, such as Parmigianino's departure for Rome in 1524. At that date, Correggio had not even started to paint, and one has the impression that a leisurely rate of execution was always anticipated. The cupola in the cathedral was not the centrepiece of a new building, as at San Giovanni. Instead, it was at the heart of an old Romanesque structure, and was not suitable for painting without a certain amount of preliminary attention. This was not arranged until a year later, when a contract was signed by Giorgio da Erba on the 23rd of November 1523. But in the meantime, a scaffolding had been constructed and the cupola inspected. There are further documents concerned with a temporary wooden covering for the cupola, which was the responsibility of Marcantonio Zucchi, and with the provision of copper to make the dome secure. Only when this work was completed could Correggio have begun to paint, although there is evidence of additional copper laying taking place later on, maybe because the initial labour was done in too much of a hurry. However, The delay no doubt suited Correggio extremely well and had presumably been taken into consideration from the outset, since he had a good deal of unfinished business at San Giovanni. It used to be believed, not least by me in the book I wrote on Correggio about 20 years ago, that a payment of the 17th of November 1530 marked the completion of the dome. But an article by Cristina Cecchinelli of 2010, which publishes a number of new notarial documents, above all concerned with the scaffolding, has demonstrated that work went on well into the 1530s. Cecchinelli argues convincingly that a previously known payment of the 29th of November 1526 is not, as previously believed, for fresco work already completed on the dome, but, on the contrary, that Correggio only got started in the summer of 1530. One of the new documents, dated the 8th of June 1530, again involves Giorgio da Erba and requires him to construct a scaffolding necessary per dipingere dicta cuba, in order to paint the said cupola, at the same time obliging him to dismantle the scaffolding once the fresco is completed, and to do so without damaging it. A second document, dated the 1st of August 1530, directly concerns Correggio. It revisits the original agreement of 1522, not just for the dome, but also for the apse and the crossing of the choir, and specifies that his guarantor in connection with these enterprises will be Scipione Montino della Rosa, a Parmesan nobleman who was one of the two fabbricieri at the time of the original signing of the contract, and more generally played a considerable part in Correggio's career. Further documents of the 23rd and the 31st May 1532 relate to the construction of scaffolding and preparation of the surfaces to be painted in the choir and apse, and would seem to indicate that by this date Correggio had all but completed his work on the dome. He died in 1534, as I've said, so the fact that he failed to execute any more of the project is no great surprise. If he made drawings for these other areas, they have not survived. The contract does not specify the fresco's subject, but merely stipulates that Correggio is to paint whatever histories are given to him. As previously stated, this may seem to suggest that the programme remained to be determined, but in fact there can be no doubt that the Assumption of the Virgin was always planned for the cupola. The Virgin was the patron saint of Parma, and her Assumption and Coronation, which are both celebrated on the 15th of August, were of particular significance to the city. The cathedral was actually dedicated to her Assumption, and it would have seemed natural to surround her with the subsidiary patron saints of the city in the squinches, the areas at the bottom of the dome. Much as she was flanked by the two most important patron saints, John the Baptist and Hilary, on the seal of the town. The details of the iconography will be discussed more fully in due course, but it is important to realise at the outset that its broad lines were probably defined before the contract was signed. The idea of an artist planning an exceptionally complex illusionistic fresco for a cupola is extremely hard to imagine, and in this instance there were two particular factors that can only have added to Correggio's difficulties. The first is that although the top part of the cupola is rounded off, at its base it is octagonal. The second is that each of its eight sides is penetrated by a substantial circular window at its base. These complications had to be borne in mind from the first, and it is likely that Correggio built himself some sort of scale model upon which to experiment. His contemporary Rosso Fiorentino did exactly that when faced by a far less illusionistically demanding decorative commission in Arezzo. Needless to say, no such model exists, but a number of preparatory drawings for the cupola have survived. Sadly, they are less informative about the evolution of the overall design than might have been hoped. The most instructive, by far, is a double-sided sheet in the Ashmolean, whose present recto is currently on display in the museum. The first point to make about it is that the present recto, there, must in fact have been drawn second, and that it is with the current verso on the left for you that we should begin. Drawn in hot orange-red chalk, it shows one octagonal section of the dome, capable of repetition all the way round, and appears to have been cut down to its present curved shape by the artist himself. He started by drawing the parapet and the prominent oculus, here surrounded by a foliate wreath decoration based on all'antica models, and then drew the figures over the top. The parapet bears a classical order, and close inspection reveals that the left and right halves are not identical. This could be interpreted as meaning that the plan involved an alternating rhythm, but it is far more likely that Correggio was adopting a practice common in architectural drawings of the period, and also found in designs for altarpiece frames, which eschewed repetition in order to show alternative options. In this instance, Correggio drew a fluted Ionic pilaster on the left, while its counterpart on the right is fluted Doric. The figures in front of the parapet are even more obviously different, but not for exactly the same reason. Here, the arrangement on the right is the easier to decipher, with a seated figure wearing some sort of headdress, in front of whom is a round-breasted sphinx, seen di sotto in su, resting on its haunches and sitting up on its front legs. On the left, it is possible to pick out a faint echoing sphinx, but the figure behind is very differently conceived. He is drawn on a much larger scale, and notably more boldly, with his head slumped onto his forearm and his legs sprawling over the edge of the parapet. In theory, he could be a prophet, balancing the Sibyl opposite, but it seems more probable that two separate moments in the evolution of the design are involved. Up above, sitting on the parapet, are two boys whose draperies dangle down as they sprawl backwards and look upwards. Both of them are in charge of their respective candelabra, which are quite hard to pick out, I know. It's unclear at this stage where the apostles, who must always have been part of the grand design, are meant to go. They are not included. When Correggio turned the sheet over, so now I'm talking about this side, he again pursued the policy of exploring various possibilities. On the left, he more or less repeated the solution from the left of the verso, with a bearded prophet sleeping on his hands, behind the sphinx with lowered head, and more evidently than before, sitting on and resting his arms on a block. A fluted pilaster, or possibly half column, this time Corinthian, is again the backdrop, and again he has drawn over it. Above is the same boy still tending the candelabrum. The solution on the right, however, is another new departure and shows considerably more signs of creative energy than anything on the comparatively timid other side of the sheet. The sphinx has gone, the fluted pilaster is replaced by an orderless block, and only the sleeping prophet remains. Behind him is a great bulging half column, and there is a drum bass at his feet. The only decorative compensation for the increase in austerity comes with the trace of a garland round the central tondo on this side only, and with the addition of a bow at the top of that oculus. All this architectural detail is very carefully planned. The base lines and cornice lines are all ruled and incised, as is the tondo, which must have been drawn with the help of a compass. Furthermore, a blank incised line, which starts at the bow and goes down to the baseline, marks the centre of the bay. However, the real changes come above the parapet, where the seated boy is supplanted by a standing youth in vigorous motion, still in conjunction with one of the candelabra, which were always intended to occupy the angles of the octagon and thus help conceal them. Something of his energy is then transferred to the relatively enormous standing figure with raised arms in the middle of the bay. He was drawn nude with his head in two different positions and then draped. It seems he must be an apostle, and if so, Correggio's plan would have involved a combination of single and paired apostles to fit all 12 of them onto the eight sides of the dome. In the final solution, they were to occupy the corners, not the centres of the bays, and the four pairs were disposed at the sides, but the principle must have remained the same. It is the nature of drawings such as this one that they are unable to inform us whether Correggio conceived of standing boys with standing apostles, or whether his idea for the boy led on to the apostle in a way that made them mutually exclusive. That may seem the more plausible interpretation, since the apostles might otherwise have got confused with the Ephebi. Although, an engraving after what must have been an autograph drawing for the side of the octagon immediately below the Virgin involves just such a melee of figures. In fact, only one further drawing in Haarlem, a much worried over fragment on the verso of a study for the figure of Eve, which will be discussed in due course, is concerned with the parapet. It is not at all easy to unravel, but appears to follow on from the Oxford recto, with which I'm comparing it, and shows a solution involving a swelling baluster in front of the prophet, and a more elaborated version of the half column and drum bass arrangement behind him. Again, there is no trace of the Sphinx. This Haarlem verso is of considerable importance for the chronology of the planning of the cupola. It was not uncovered until comparatively recently. It's quite normal for drawings to be stuck down, and we now unstick them. And is clearly cropped from a larger sheet in accordance with the extent of the drawing on its recto. When it is turned through 90 degrees, it becomes possible to decipher a preparatory study for the lower half of the figure of Venus in the School of Love in the National Gallery in London. So, I hope you can see foot, knee, swelling thigh and so on, corresponding with all this. Since the cupola study clearly follows the study of Venus, and since the School of Love is datable to around 1523 to 25, the cupola studies on the Haarlem sheet cannot be any earlier than that. Very probably, Correggio did not start serious planning on the design until the cupola was fit to paint. The whole conception of prophets and sibyls with sphinxes grew out of his designs for the nave frieze in San Giovanni Evangelista. They were to have no part in the finished fresco, although the sphinxes came to assume a decorative role lower down at the level of the squinches. Presumably this zone was what the Fabricieri and Correggio had in mind when they drew up a contract which referred to the imitation of bronze and marble. And they may have intended to have bronze sphinxes and marble prophets. Their presence in the flesh, even if confined to the near side of the parapet, could hardly have failed to prove distracting in terms of the narrative being enacted higher up. As far as one can judge, the overall scheme at this stage was very close in spirit to that of the dome of San Giovanni, and would necessarily have involved gigantic apostles around a centrally placed assumption. In the event, Correggio's revision was a masterly one, which cleared the zone in front of the parapet for the apostles, and therefore allowed them to be even more towering in stature without taking up the whole height of the cupola. Instead, the Ephebi remained relatively low above the parapet, and the centre of the vault was liberated for the full drama of the Assumption proper. Alas, this transformation is not chronicled by drawings, because the rest of them, without exception, represent studies of details executed after the new conception had been developed. None of these details relates to the simpler initial scheme, but given how many drawings must have been made and how few survive, it would be unwise to infer that none ever existed. Although the execution of the fresco necessarily proceeded from the top downwards, the bottom of the design had to be settled before the upper part. In examining the remaining drawings, it therefore seems best to start at the parapet and move upwards. To begin with, there are a handful of sheets of the Apostles. They are all consistent in various respects. Each sheet represents a single apostle, and they invariably show them without feet on account of the Di Sotto in Su perspective, because their feet are hidden behind the parapet they stand on, a visual ploy that's already anticipated on the Oxford Rector. Another feature they almost all square is their squaring, as the one on the left shows. This is unsurprising. Correggio must have been constantly aware of the need to transfer the design and enlarge it. Throughout, a fairly uniform scale was employed. Some of the studies can be associated with particular apostles in the fresco, while others cannot. Those that show less recoil may be earlier ideas, since this may have been an effect, along with the billowing draperies, the Correggio developed only gradually. There's a big recoil and a good correspondence. In one particular instance, the same apostle, dramatically recoiling from the radiance of the Virgin's ascent, is studied twice on different sheets, both times distinctly schematically, but in the earlier with almost no attention being paid to facial type or features. The next group of studies concerns the Ephebi, and again a number of the sheets correspond closely to actual figures in the fresco. In reality, the heads of the apostles impinge upon this zone, but in the drawings, the boys are invariably shown without these interruptions. Thus, for example, in this drawing in Lisbon, which is unusual in its use of pen in addition to the habitual red chalk, the seated boy's trailing left foot is shown, whereas in the fresco it is occluded by the drapery of one of the apostles. A sheet formerly in the Woodner collection and now in a private collection, which has a ground plan on its verso, which I'm showing you, shows the same phenomenon, with the whole of one segment of the octagon being included and the standing youth stretching out towards a non-existent candelabrum. Similarly, his legs are included, although in the fresco they too are obscured by an apostle. Only the way his seated companion's left arm trails away suggests that any provision is being made for the figures in front. The dispositions and poses of the boys in the drawing are remarkably close to the fresco, but there is one fascinating difference. The standing boy's arms half conceal his face in the painting, which is a visual complication or obfuscation of the sort the entire work abounds in. Both the Lisbon and ex-Woodner sheets are predominantly linear, but the latter does include some shading, and in two squared drawings in the Louvre, which no doubt originally formed part of the same sheet, this is more evident, and the candelabra are included. The pose of one of the figures in one of them matches that of an Ephebi in the engraving after a lost drawing I showed earlier. A double-sided sheet in the Fondazione Il Correggio, which was rediscovered about 20 years ago, but previously known through an engraving dating from the 18th century, has a study for the Apostles and the Phoebe of the section of the dome immediately below the Virgin on its recto, and the verso, which you're seeing in black and white, consists of a faint study, very faint study, of the same section in red chalk, combined with a series of architectural elevations. Among the figures here is the Apostle studied in two drawings previously shown. Like the Lisbon drawing, this one is executed in simple pen outline over red chalk, and it is tempting to suppose that this extreme simplification may have represented the final stage of Correggio's preparation immediately before the no less schematic sinopia, or underdrawing. Also like the Lisbon drawing, this one is squared, but in addition has two angled lines which define the limits of the octagonal face of the dome, as well as curved lines at the top, perhaps suggestive of the rounding off of the centre of the cupola. This is one of the most severely damaged parts of the fresco, but it is still possible to see that Correggio made some minor adjustments between this drawing and what he actually painted. An even more instructive sheet as regards Correggio's overall method of planning is a drawing in red chalk in Frankfurt. It is centred on the figure of Eve and the women behind her, and must have been made at a relatively late stage in the design process. It is extensively squared, and at the top, where the squaring stops, it is overlapped by the segment of a circle, again evidently drawn with the help of a compass. The system of squaring involves three different baselines which correspond to the sides of the octagon. What all of this proves is that in order to achieve an effect of infinite space on the surface of an octagonal dome, Correggio felt he had to respect the shape, at least until a certain height. Furthermore, he considered the composition in large units, even if he then restudied it eighth by eighth. The simplest way of gauging the extent of his success in achieving the illusion of continuity is to look at a reproduction of a detail of the upper part only, and to try to work out where the joins are. The proof that this drawing was executed at a late stage is not merely the correspondence between it and the fresco, but the existence of four further studies of Eve, two of which are certainly earlier. They illustrate Correggio's economy of invention to perfection. The first of them, on the left here, is probably the sheet in Haarlem, whose verso has already been discussed. It shows Eve as a beautiful naked girl, her hair unbound and her breasts prominent, with her right arm brought back across her body in a gesture that may ultimately derive from a Venus pudica, a classical Venus pudica, but which conceals nothing. A putto seated on a cloud faces her and holds the apple of her original sin. Red chalk was the initial medium employed, and then pen was used to outline the final positions that the artist deemed most satisfactory. They, in turn, were his point of departure for a far more worked-up red chalk drawing in the British Museum, on the right, where the chiaroscuro is unusually heavy, and a slightly older, grinning child has joined the couple. This solution was not used for Eve, as the Frankfurt drawing, a lusciously ripe red chalk sheet in the Louvre, which is what I'm showing you here, and the fresco itself all demonstrate. Instead, Eve was shown proffering the fruit across the great divide to Adam. The first conception of Eve was not wasted, however, for the woman directly behind her in the fresco has her right arm and face in much the same position, the only real difference being that she is clothed. Indeed, a somewhat damaged red chalk drawing in a private collection, which you're seeing, shows both figures and a number of more and less distinctly realised putti. A drawing of Adam with Abraham and Isaac at Windsor is almost unique in being connected with the other male side. It too has a curved segment of a circle at the top and is executed in red chalk with pen outlines as the finishing touches. The omission of the Virgin's outstretched right hand is the only real difference between it and the fresco. The way in which Adam's left arm is folded back under his chin is a mirror image of the first conception of Eve. The sequence of execution of the drawings is not easy to reconstruct, but it is hard to believe that both Adam and Eve were ever intended to be so similar. On the contrary, Adam's present attitude seems to be a pensive response to Eve's tempting offer. A now fragmentary head study, which you see below on the left, from a severely cropped sheet, is almost a cross between Adam and Abraham. Three studies survive for the all-important figure of the Virgin, two on the recto and verso of a sheet in the Kupferstichkabinett, Dresden, and the third in the British Museum. In the case of the Dresden drawing, and you're seeing both sides, it is clear that one side was traced through from the other, but the initial study probably derived from a tracing too. It is tempting to suppose that the present verso came first, not so much because the pose is reversed with respect to the fresco, but rather because the frontal conception of the head, with rolling eyes looking upwards, is profoundly unlike the solution found in the fresco. By contrast, the recto, which is what you see below, already has the raised profile more or less as in the finished work. The British Museum sheet is a very different type of drawing because it represents a later stage in Correggio's thinking. It is far more resolved, with the red chalk more confidently applied and hardly a contour pentimento in sight. It also excludes the putti entirely, but does show the Virgin of the Assumption, who is supported on clouds. In only one respect, albeit a significant one, does it differ from the Dresden recto and indeed the fresco, namely in the astonishingly spread-eagled legs of the Virgin. Even in a work whose flouting of convention appears to have been the object of adverse comment from the first, this would have been a uniquely indecorous solution. Regardless of any intervening clouds or draperies, the Virgin's bare feet could not have failed to reveal the splay of her legs. In the end, Correggio reverted to the solution of the Dresden sheet, most probably without requiring the veto of the authorities. Self-censorship must have been a fact of life in this period, especially for the most imaginative spirits. Apart, possibly, from a single angel on a drawing in Rugby School, which also has studies of Correggio's altarpiece, the Madonna della Scodella, on it, which I'm not showing, there are no surviving preparations for the extraordinary living stream of the angelic host surrounding the Virgin. No doubt Correggio made small models out of clay or wax and suspended them from strings to draw them from a multiplicity of viewpoints. Vasari stated that Garofalo was the first artist in Lombardy, by which he meant northern Italy, to employ this practice. And this may be true, but Correggio's use of it is self-evident and may be demonstrated by reconstructing comparable models. It seems important, before concluding with the squinches, to consider the basic subject matter of the fresco, which is so self-evident that it has tended to inhibit detailed discussion. The first thing to understand, as Padre Resta did in the 18th century, is that the open space around which the apostles are thronged is, in some sense at least, the Virgin's tomb. We, in the body of the church so far below, look up at the apostles, at the Ephebi and the burning candelabra, and witness the Virgin being received into the company of heaven. Correggio deliberately avoided identifying individual apostles in the usual manner. There are no attributes, no colour-coded draperies here, but instead concentrated on the variety of their overtly physical expressions of their emotional responses. The apostles nearest the Virgin here, the ones we first see from the middle of the nave, are the ones most dazzled by the radiance of her passing. The force, as of a mighty rushing wind, all but knocks them off their feet, and their arms are raised as if to fend off imaginary blows. Moving outwards from them, our gaze confronts no less surprised but more delighted figures, with great swathes of drapery hurrying across their bodies as they stretch their arms as wide as possible to encompass the extent of their feelings, and at the same time to echo the gesture of the Virgin herself. Since the Virgin was laid in the tomb by the apostles immediately before her Assumption, it is her funeral that is represented. That explains, at least in part, the inclusion of the Ephebi. They are shown lighting and tending candelabra, and also burning branches in the flames to produce clouds of aromatic smoke. By this period, candles were an essential feature of any funeral, and they allowed Correggio to fill what would otherwise have been a troublesome hiatus between the earthly and the heavenly zones. As regards the Assumption of the Virgin and her immediately subsequent coronation, two main ways of treating the episode had evolved by this date, both of which allowed of almost infinite variations of detail. The first tended to favour the coronation and presented the event timelessly, taking place before the whole company of heaven, as constituted at the time of the work's execution, and naturally reflecting the preferences in terms of saints of the patrons. The second was strictly historical and only included those of the blessed whose arrival in heaven preceded that of the Virgin. This is the way Correggio elected, always instructed, to show her appearance in paradise. And in fact, he has confined himself to the Old Testament worthies whom Christ released from limbo. Judaism is among the religions to segregate men and women in services of worship, and this circumstance was often reflected in Renaissance representations of the marriage of the Virgin, with the men folk standing on Joseph's side and the women folk on Mary's. Correggio's paradise is similarly arranged, and some, but by no means all of its company, are identifiable. Sadly, I do not have time to pick them out for you. Above the Virgin, and descending feet first to greet her, is a figure whose identity has been much debated. Most critics have assumed he must be Christ, who does indeed meet his mother in most representations of the subject, and would otherwise be perplexingly absent. However, it is as well to admit that there are problems with this identification. The figure in the fresco is beardless and wears green and white. Nothing about him, such as stigmata or a cruciform halo, suggests Christ. The other possibility is that he is an angel. Discussion of the Assumption on the basis of photographs is incomparably more deceiving than that exercise usually is. It diminishes the extraordinarily difficult job of working out who's who, and it does not give you a crick in the neck. And by the way, if you ever go, take binoculars. They will be of inestimable value. That crick in the neck is an inevitable consequence of trying to see the fresco whole, the common experience of anyone who has been to Parma. By contrast, from the body of the nave, before the steps leading up to the presbytery, which was necessarily the location from which the majority of the faithful saw the fresco, only part of the cupola is disclosed. That is where the Virgin is, and there is even an hour of the afternoon when the sun's rays passing through one of the windows put a natural spotlight on her and bathe her in warmth. In the cathedral, the nave view is the main one, but some parts of the decoration, such as the side apostles, are best seen from the transepts, and the western squinches are best seen from the choir. However, if the cupola of San Giovanni Evangelista had privileged viewpoints for the Benedictines, then it seems right to describe this decoration as essentially democratic. The cathedral cupola should have been Correggio's crowning achievement, but there is good reason to believe it was nothing of the kind. The anecdote about one of the canons of the cathedral denouncing it as a stew of frog's legs is apparently supported by a letter from Bernardino Gatti, written when he was at work on the cupola of the Church of the Steccata, just a few hundred yards away in Parma, in which he refers ominously to what happened to Correggio in the cathedral. In the last analysis, the criticism is not wholly without substance either, for although the protagonist is clear enough, and although there is a real sense of movement, the composition is hard to read and must furthermore have come as a shock to a provincial public, even one educated by Correggio's own recent efforts in San Giovanni Evangelista. Some of Correggio's foreshortenings border on the indecent as well as the deliberately virtuoso. And I'm assuming, by the way, that the V sign didn't mean anything in Renaissance Italy. So that's just a strange chance for us as Brits. Legend has it that when the cathedral canons were minded to destroy the fresco or have it whitewashed over, Titian himself assured them that if they had been able to fill the space of the cupola with gold coins, they would still not have paid the master enough. The squinches in the cathedral are by definition separated from the cupola proper, but the figures in them participate in the heavenly rejoicing above. Each of the four corners is occupied by one of the patron saints of the city, who have not invariably been correctly identified. In Vasari's words, the saints are St. John the Baptist, who is holding a lamb, here on the left, St. Joseph, the husband of Our Lady, here on the right, St. Bernard Uberti of Florence, cardinal and bishop of that city, on the left here, and another bishop, namely St. Hilary. Until recently, St. Joseph was invariably mistaken for Thomas, who was indeed a patron saint of Parma. However, the figures... However, the figure's attributes, physiognomy, and costume all identify him as Joseph, as elsewhere in Correggio's work, most obviously in the Madonna della Scodella, Joseph is elderly but robust, grey-haired and short-bearded, and is dressed in orange and grey. The inherent interest of this identification is increased by the fact that it leads to a fuller understanding of the history of the commission. It can be shown that although the original scheme must indeed have required St. Thomas, that's to say in 1522, there was a change of programme and he was replaced by St. Joseph. The Baptist and St. Hilary were especially revered in Parma. I've explained they were on the seal of the town. And Bernard Uberti had long-standing associations with both the city and the cathedral, where he is buried. By contrast, Thomas had joined the number of the patron saints only in the wake of the lifting of the French siege of Parma in 1521, which took place on the 21st of December, his feast day, less than a year before Correggio signed his contract on the 3rd of November, 1522. It was the subsequent creation of a new patron saint that must have caused Thomas to be supplanted. On the 19th of March, 1528, the town council of Parma unanimously agreed to adopt St. Joseph, whose day it was, as one of their patron saints. We now know that the squinches, like the rest of the dome, could not have been painted before the summer of 1530. Much more interesting is the fact that in their present form, they cannot have been invented before March 1528. This is proved by a series of four red chalk drawings for the squinches, all of a piece stylistically, which include a St. Joseph along with the three older patrons. They provide an invaluable touchstone for Correggio's late drawing style in his final years. In the case of St. Bernard, whom you see here, there also exists a very similar, if marginally less resolved study, the one on the left. A second drawing of, and there he is, you can see him, compare him with how he ends up. A second drawing of St. John the Baptist reveals a more energetic but still remarkably delicate touch and portrays him as altogether slighter and less mature. Executed initially in red chalk and then partially gone over in pen, the sheet shows the Baptist intently cradling his lamb and represents an earlier conception of the design. In the fresco, he appears much more aware of his surroundings, his gaze blazing with zeal as he confronts the world. Where the two facing patrons, those you see from the nave, John the Baptist and Hilary, turn inwards, the two who are visible only from the crossing and the presbytery face outwards. Again, they divide into one who looks out more or less frontally, St. Joseph, and one looking sideways, St. Bernard. This latter is in almost pure profile, and like Hilary, he looks across the divide towards the Baptist. It is under his feet that there lurks the famous figure of an angel, who also plays the part of Ganymede in a canvas by Correggio in Vienna. When it was assumed that the dome was completed in 1530, it was taken as read that he was plucked out of the fresco and repeated in the mythology, which is very much in Correggio's last style. But this is now far less certain. No less fascinating is the angel in the St. Joseph squinch, for whom there appears to be a preliminary cartoon in the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. Although a direct link with the head of the Virgin above has often been suggested, and while it is true that they are very similar in their foreshortening and in the turn of the head, they are not the same way round. Given what a crucial feature the direction of the Virgin's gaze was, and bearing in mind how much depended upon it in terms of the larger composition, it is hard to believe it was reversed at the cartoon stage. What is more, although the Virgin's eye looks straight up at the figure descending to meet her, it is entirely proper that her whole attitude should tend towards Eve's side. There has been an enormous amount of speculation about the cartoons for the cathedral, but all that is actually known is that there was a black chalk sinopia underdrawing. The fragment of it, retrieved during restoration, which you see on the left here, now in the Galleria Nazionale in Parma, which shows the head of the Virgin, is remarkable, even by Correggio's standards, for its combination of simplicity and confidence. In the contract, Correggio agreed to paint figures in imitation of bronze and marble, as well as to the life. Their possible accommodation in his early designs in the form of prophets and sibyls and sphinxes has been considered in relation to the Ishmaelian drawing. But when that scheme was modified, they were not completely forgotten. There are garland-bearing winged geniuses in imitation of marble at the springing of the arches of the dome, which I'm not showing you. More significantly, the arched windows in the zone between the squinches are topped by seated sphinxes looking upwards and by winged geniuses receiving garlands below, all imitating marble. Gilt bronze reliefs are counterfeited on either side of these openings and show putti with cornucopia astride dolphins accompanied by serpents and apples, presumably in allusion to the Virgin's role as the second Eve. What appears to be an autographed red chalk drawing for one of these is in the Accademia in Venice. And that's what you see on the left here. If these monochrome areas reveal economy of effort, then the opposite is true of the still life vignettes that fill the spandrels above the shell niches inhabited by the patron saints. Like them, and like the frescoes above, they are based on a colour scheme dominated by muted greens, oranges, and violets, and boast acorns, chestnuts, and turnips, as here, as well as more predictable bunches of grapes and oranges and lemons. They serve as a telling reminder that even this most illusionistic and fantastical of decorations was grounded in the observation of reality. Thank you very much.